It is Saturday, March 20th, 2010, 10:06 a.m. on the Central Coast of California. Today on Geek Speak, geek news and the second half of your questions and comments about technology. The bandwidth for geekspeak.org is provided by GNI, gnihosting.com. It's time now for Geek Speak.
So you're living in a world that you don't know nothing about. Sitting at your keyboard paralyzed with doubt. But just sit tight, we're here to help you out. We don't know it all, but we'll tell you what we found out. And if it's all Greek to you, then let us speak geek to you. We're here each week for you on your radio.
Geek Speak and KOSP is supported by Henry J. Ramirez, DDS in Santa Cruz, specializing in cosmetic and family dentistry, using digital technology for less radiation, and offering one-appointment crowns and veneers. For appointments and more information, 423-2447.
So if it's all Greek to you, then let us speak geek to you. We're here each week for you on your radio.
Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gaps between geeks and the rest of humanity. I'm your host, Lyle Troxell. Please keep in mind the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KOSP. Today's theme song was from Michael Saunders, and thank you, Michael, for that. If you'd like to participate in Geek Speak by writing us a song or producing cover art for every episode we do, please do so by emailing us information about where to find your content. And this content on KOSP during this hour is Creative Commons, share and share alike, non-commercial. You're welcome to use it for other things as long as you let people know and you offer your content you create the same way we offer it in a shared way. And of course, don't make money off us unless you talk to us first. Thanks. The geeks today are Miles Elam. He's a slacker and political junkie. Good morning, Miles.
Good morning.
We also have Alex Leas, and Alex Leas is Southern California Application Security Analyst Correspondent. Good morning, Alex.
Good morning, Lyle.
Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
And we have Lindsay Lonnie. Lindsay Lonnie is an Application Engineer.
Good morning, Lyle.
Good morning. Well, thank you all for being here. We're going to do some geek news in the first half. In the second half, we're going to answer people's calls and questions and comments about technology. So we'll start off the show with Mr. Alex Leas about Comcast.
About Comcast. All right. Comcast, you know, who we all hear evil things about, apparently is going to be upgrading or making available a 100 megabit service to residential service for their internet connections.
Can I just say yum?
Yeah, that sounds really nice, doesn't it?
Well, 100 megabit is fast. It's like a corporate kind of local speeds.
God, I wish I had 100 megabit from one end of the country to the other through my corporate networks.
Oh, you work at university.
Yeah, that'd be nice.
That's assuming the other end is fast enough as well.
Yeah, and I mean, the thing
and
is...
And your hard drive is fast enough to do anything with it.
I mean, with Comcast upping this to 100 megabits, it's not like... I mean, as the article actually makes note, it's, you know, because you get a faster speed doesn't mean that the internet's going to get faster with you. But at the same time, it's going to be snappier. I mean, you're going to not have the latency when you do that initial connection. Things are going to be a little bit faster. You can do that big download while watching a movie at the same time and not have your buffering go every 5 minutes while
right.
you're watching it.
It's true.
So, you know, it'll be a lot nicer. And the internet has been getting, you know, faster. So.
Do they have any prices? Do they have any prices yet?
I haven't seen anything on pricing yet. Right. I'm guessing it's probably going to be, you know, a bit more than what they currently charge, but they can't go too overboard, I don't think. And eventually, the prices are going to shift down.
Is that 100 megabit up and downstream or just downstream?
It didn't really
most
get that detailed.
Down,
yeah, it's mostly just like kind of an early hint as to what they're coming out with soon.
It's great. All right. Well, I look forward to it. And Comcast, of course, is how I'm actually getting my service. So I'd love to get 100 megabit. Thank you, Alex.
Yeah. Oh, and just real quick, over the next 12 to 18 months is what they're saying.
Cool. Thanks. And with this extra bandwidth, you might be able to help people help astronomers map the universe. Lindsay?
So Galaxy Zoo has actually been around for a little while, but there's a new iteration, Galaxy Zoo 2. And the Galaxy Zoo files contain almost 250,000 galaxies which have been imaged with a camera attached to a robotic telescope as part of the Sloan Digital Sky Survey project. And in order to understand how the galaxies formed, we need the public's help to classify them according to their shapes. So you can just go and donate your time. It's all open source project.
And, yeah, we have covered this before. I think Ben covered it. And the idea is that the human eye is actually still better at this kind of detection and categorizing than computer systems can be, especially right. when you use a lot of people and you look at their average response rather than just one person's idea of what whether it's a spiral or not.
Gotcha.
So what's the new addition to it?
Basically, the new addition is galactic collisions.
So oh, cool.
They want people to sign up and look at the patterns of what a galaxy looks like after two collide and try and match those patterns now.
Oh, cool. And, of course, a galaxy collision, when a large body like that collides with another body, it's not like they're actually physically hitting each other, but their gravity tears each other apart or very much alters how they function. That's neat. So they've got some images that are clearly, this is two things colliding or just have collided and
exactly.
what's going on. Oh, cool. Okay, that's Galaxy Zoo. And, of course, anything we're talking about today on GeekSpeak, you're welcome to find out on our website. We post all the links and such about what's happening. In a minute, Alex is going to talk about iTunes fraud. But first, Miles, scientists talking about quantum mechanics. I love quantum mechanics. So it's always
yes, one of the most common examples we hear is Schrodinger's cat, that idea of the cat that has a vial of cyanide that it might be subject to being released and killing the cat. And before the box opens, though, you don't know whether the cat's dead or alive.
And specifically, the triggering effect of killing the cat is like a particle breaking down or not.
Right, a radioactive isotope, yeah.
Right. And so it's an unknown state, and quantum physics says that when things are an unknown, it's actually a probability wave, that it either exists in both ways. And so the question is that cat actually alive and dead at the same time?
Right. In our normal world, we think of the cat as either alive or it's dead. It
right.
has either died. But in the quantum world, the cat is both alive and dead until we observe it.
Right.
But the thing is, this was always at the quantum state. It was always very small state. It was always done through inference, things like mm-hmm. that. A group of scientists at the University of California, Santa Barbara, have created a tiny metal paddle, something that apparently is visible with the naked eye, although I don't know if the action would be, that they set to vibrate in a quantum state, but at the same time it's not vibrating. So something that is large enough to be approaching our scale
mm-hmm.
that is acting in a quantum mechanical way.
What do you mean it's not vibrating?
It can be found to be vibrating or not vibrating.
Ah, I see.
At the same time.
Depending on how you pass light around it. So it's the same kind of detection system which showed the duality of light, in the sense that you can show that a light will travel through two slits and interfere with itself, but if you send only one photon at a time, it'll choose which path, assuming that you're looking at the paths.
Mm-hmm.
So this is an example of that, where the object they're using is not just two slits. They're actually using a physical thing that has a duality.
Right. Now,
okay,
when
that's
I say it's visible with the human eye, I mean it's like on the very edge. The actual paddle, or what they call a quantum drum, is only 30 micrometers long, or micrometers.
Yeah, that's pretty small. I don't think you can see that with the human eye. But you can see a reflection of light off of it.
Right. But you may be able to see the entire mechanism, but the active portion would be too small for them to see.
And it still has a duality?
Yes.
Okay,
it's by far the largest item that we've been able to see this at. And the problem is that if you have a large item, there's so many interactions with our world that it interrupts anything that we would expect as a pure quantum state.
Right.
So the fact that we have something that this
range. One of the concepts is that says that this Schrodinger cat thing is not really a problem is that, well, there's neutrons flying through the box. There's information passing, potential information
right.
passing. And therefore, as soon as you start doing that, you're actually, that is the state of witnessing it. You know, you are creating the breakdown of the probability wave.
Right.
So in this situation, they're seeing that it's actually a pretty large object. It clearly has other things can be interfering with it and touching
well,
it, and yet it's still staying in that
although
state.
They did go through a large amount of effort to get things not interacting with it. For example, they cooled it down to below a tenth of a Kelvin.
Yeah, that's cold.
And they're working with a superconducting electrical circuit.
What is the actual detection that it has a duality?
That's a fine question. We should ask them that.
You're listening to GeekSpeak. My name's Lyle Trox. That's Miles Elam. Thank you very much. Alex, what's going on with iTunes? I use iTunes all the time.
All right, iTunes. Now, this isn't really new news. I mean, this is something that's been going on for years. But it's recently come to my attention with some, you know, just something new came to my attention. A friend of mine emailed me this one story about somebody who was caught with fraud and with Apple and their iTunes, you know, and their EULA that iTunes has.
End user license agreement.
Yeah.
EULA, right.
Right. And so fraud has been used, or iTunes has been used for fraud for a while. You know, some of the things that people who are trying to commit credit card fraud do is once they have stolen credit cards, they get them in bulk and they need to test whether or not the people they got them from are giving them valid cards or not, so they can test their quality. And what they do is they try to do small charges on the credit card that people might not notice or might just let go by, and they just see, hey, does this go through and is this a valid credit card? iTunes has actually been used as a target for that because it's small charges and a lot of people have iTunes. So if they see a little dollar charge in their car, they go, oh, my kid probably just paid, got that. So no big deal.
Oh.
And then, so they let it go through and they just don't think about it. But what really has happened is that the person who had stolen all those credit card numbers is validating those cards so that they can then take those numbers and print them on fake cards and sell those.
Do they do that kind of thing?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. So, wow. Okay. And therefore, and the thing that's clever about that is the person most likely will let it go.
Right, exactly, because everyone's got iTunes.
Now, iTunes, of course, I mean, Apple, of course, is going to start knowing when people, I mean, if you do this in mass, some people will never have used iTunes, and they'll get their credit card charge of a dollar, and they'll go, what's going on? They'll contact Apple, and Apple will be like, oh, never mind, and give the money back. And of course,
well, see, there's the little rub there, because, I mean, it's done in a few different ways. Sometimes people have actually had their existing accounts hacked. Mm-hmm. And nobody's, you know, there's still uncertainty as to how that happened, whether or not they did it directly over against iTunes, which, you know, is less likely, or if they found ways to steal the person's password for their iTunes account, either through malware or, you know, who knows what exact method they use, but they got it and they get in. And then they put in someone else's credit card in their account. So they're kind of masking themselves greatly. And it also makes it harder for Apple to really detect. And, you know, that ends up doing is they're testing somebody else's credit card, a stolen credit card, with this person's account. And the person doesn't even, you know, notice it. They don't see it on their credit card statement. But then when the person who does notice it on their credit card statement goes and contacts their credit card company, the credit card company disputes it and cancels the charge. Mm-hmm. And Apple says the balance goes back onto the account. And the person with the original account that got hacked is being held liable for the amounts. And Apple is you know, recently, as far as this article I saw, which is, of course, not a statement from Apple.
No, they rarely make those.
Right. So, as far as what they're claiming is that Apple is saying, you know, it's in our EULA. We're not responsible for how your account gets used. But that person, unless they gave out their password, wasn't involved. You know, they weren't. It wasn't from their computer. It was from somewhere else.
And I would assume that this stance is pretty rare. For corporations to do, right? I mean, aren't you pretty protected normally on a credit card situation?
In credit card situations, but Apple's not seeing it as a credit card situation. It's you and your account. The credit card is somebody else's card, and that person was covered.
So your account still has a negative balance with Apple.
Exactly.
Uh-huh.
And I can understand Apple, you know, one of the reasons I can see Apple doing that is, oh, I'm, you know, my kid went and logged into my computer and charged things.
Problem.
Yeah, exactly. That's where their statement of we're not responsible for the use of your account. But when it's a hacker or somewhere coming from outside,
that's Apple's going to run into a court situation here, because what they're doing of producing credit and saying you owe and giving resources for that, they are a form of bank in the sense that there's a debt owed. I mean, that's going to fall under. There's a problem there.
There is definitely an issue, and I think it becomes more an issue because iTunes is being targeted for this kind of fraud and use to test cards this way, more people are going to be impacted by it.
And the more people that are impacted on it, the less Apple can stand.
Exactly. Apple's
going
to eventually have to change their tune because there's no way that...
All right. Thank you very much for that update on iTunes fraud. I guess I got to be careful. I don't save my password, so I have to put in my password all the time I use it.
And on a personal note, I actually just recently, within the last month or so, had my credit card canceled because there was little $1 charges detected. And they weren't actually full charges. They do pre-auths.
Right.
And the bank detected them and called me about it. And they've been calling me for months, and nothing I saw was concerning. But then there were these three that from three different places, three different states in the South. I'm like, I have no idea what they were. So they canceled it. Oddly enough, Wells Fargo is the one who told me about that. You know, they called, contacted me.
They
said,
provider.
Yeah, we think you have fraud, et cetera. They told me all in advance before I even saw anything, and I probably wouldn't have seen anything.
It's a dangerous thing because if you are getting those pre-auth credit cards, make sure that basically it's a confirmation the credit card's functional.
Right.
Because there's an algorithm to know if the number is a valid number, but that's an easy thing to know. So that you normally have to tell, you know, say, hey, bank, would it be okay if I charge? And the bank says, yeah, it's okay. So it's this pre-authorization kind of thing. That, of course, is perfect to set up before you do identity theft as well, because you're confirming that the user that you think it is, you have ability
that you
to
have
access
a real
credit
card. Yeah, exactly. It's and that way it never ever shows up on the statement because pre-auths don't
right.
go through.
Right, you wouldn't see it on your statement. Right.
Right, but Wells Fargo caught it.
It's good that they're doing that. And it makes sense that the banks are going to have to do that because, of course, they are liable. And it is scary. The theft is always scary because someone's going to be buying a car in your name. I mean, there's some pretty serious charges.
I canceled my card and got a new number.
Well, thanks, Alex. Lindsay, you're going to tell me about translation?
Yeah, so stumbled across this that a friend recommended, worldwidelexicon.org, and it's a web API that enables you to add collaborative translation to any website. And their vision is to create the multilingual web, and it uses contribution, it's not just machine translation. They're also asking people to contribute, mm-hmm. So it's kind of wiki-esque.
And that's kind of a necessity when you're dealing with language translation because you can't really map the thought process between two languages with a computer without intelligence.
Yeah, exactly.
Interesting. So are they're doing it such that you enter a website and you can see what other people have written about it, what the default translation is, and then if people have modified it and wikified it, if you will, in a different language?
I don't believe that you would see all the translations. There's some sort of way that they're determining the best, quote-unquote, best possible translation, and when you reach a page, it's going to serve whichever is deemed the best.
But you're browsing through their website. Kind of like a proxy.
It's something that you would install in your browser.
Oh,
so they have an API. It's all. It's going to basically be released in late March under BSD license.
Hmm.
They're also partnering with some other .orgs that do professional translations. So
interesting.
Yeah.
One of my colleagues at UCSC and a friend of mine, Warren Sack, partnered with Swad Brooks, I believe, at MIT to do a project like this. They called it Translation Map, and it was designed to be like a location-based translation. So let's say I want to send a message to someone in a certain province in Italy. I would write it in English, and I would say it's for that area. And somebody else would write it and translate it in any form that they language they knew. And so another copy of it would exist in another language. Maybe it would go through French. Someone else would pick it up and then kind of deliver. The idea being that a message needs multiple people to kind of pass along, kind of like the Crier days in
right.
Europe. And that idea is a really cool concept, but of course it's a really complicated. And it concerns me if the idea that right now if I read something, even if it's really incorrect, if I read something and it's in Japanese and I don't know Japanese and I'm dealing with trying to figure that out, I know inherently that I've got a language barrier, and it's very apparent to me that this is – my understanding is one of the major keys of problems in trying to get the knowledge that I'm getting from that website. And it would be very problematic, and I might have to ask somebody that knows Japanese that I might trust. But – if I instead install an application that does the translation for me and I'm reading it in English, I can assume that what I'm reading in English is the actual word, if you will, from that site, which it's not. It's a translation. So that idea of translation is ignored so much in our culture. It scares me to think that you might install something and start thinking the world all speaks one language and has one way of thinking, which it doesn't. Miles, you have something to add to this? You know a lot about language.
There was a class recently at UCSC that was just about translation theory.
Mm-hmm.
That's the entire focus of the class. And mm-hmm. unfortunately, I had just finished all my studies and I didn't have a chance to take the class. But the gist of it was translation is about control and power.
Because, creepy.
Well, it may be a necessary aspect, but at the same time, you are saying, okay, here's this other form. Now I'm going to manipulate it in such a way that I can understand it, or you're going to compromise your own understanding to try to be as close to the original as possible. That one way or another, you're subordinating one form of communication to another.
Right.
And then the politics of that. And it is necessary because we need to understand each other. But there is a power dynamic there that isn't always recognized. Hmm. And a computer definitely won't recognize that.
Yeah. And I mean, I guess the reason it strikes me as so fearful for me, not fearful but concerning, is that you see so many times people quoting ancient text that's clearly in a different language. And they say they meant this by it, and it's this minutia about mm-hmm. the translation. It has nothing to do with what the actual meaning was, because you're not in the native language. You can't know what the actual meaning
right,
was.
A single verse from the Bible that was written in Aramaic.
The Bible's a great example. Yeah. You know, people quote it all the time and say, this means this. And you're like, yeah, but that's taking two steps of language translation.
Oh, at least.
At least. And then because you're dealing with an old text, which is actually a translation of an original text, and, of course, that language that's actually being used wasn't spoken when it was translated. So it was inference. And it was the translator more than anybody else putting knowledge into it. It's a big process. And we ignore it all the time.
Yeah, when I think of the Bible, things like Aramaic going to Greek, translated to Latin, and then translated to, you know...
King's English.
To proto-French, for example, and then to an English, which affected that, and then...
And then arguing about, like, a syntactical sentence structure, going, right. This
and,
means this. Like,
and what? Then being read to people that may not know the history.
And
the anthropology.
And not understanding the complexity of multiple languages. I mean, even if you understand two languages, I'm told, I don't, you understand that when you think in a language and you try to translate that into a language, you're making an artistic
decision. You get a
second decision.
Voice. Like, when you start talking in another language, you take on many times a second persona.
Yeah.
Because it's the person that I'm speaking in this other language. Because your native language doesn't really apply in many ways.
Weren't you telling me about a professor at UCSC that has multiple native languages?
There are many at UCSC that have this, at most universities, as a matter of fact. But this one in particular, although apparently there are a couple there, speaks about 30.
Yeah. And four languages before puberty. Right, so that stage of life where you can really consume a language and make it your own.
Yeah, he was taught two languages from very early age.
Hmm? Who is it?
Vlad Godzic.
And if you're at UCSC, take a class. You had a great experience, right?
Yes, I did. So he has no native tongue. That's what he says.
Yeah.
But once you get to that point, the nuance between languages and stuff kind of
blurs
together.
Can you, I mean, you know Spanish relatively well. Can you give me an example of thinking in a different language and something that doesn't really have a translation you have to...
Oh, sure. I can think of something that comes up with the first year of Spanish.
Okay.
The verbs estar and ser. They both mean to be. In English, we only have to be. So I am a student versus I'm at home. Okay. They're both I am, you know, they're both to be. But they are distinct items in Spanish that roughly you can say one is permanent and one is transient. To say I am at home,
estoy en casa, where you are right now.
Right, would be a temporary estoy en casa.
And I'm a slacker.
As opposed to,
or if I'm it's a permanent thing.
Right, if I'm a salesman, you know, soy vendedor, that would be, that is an aspect of myself. It's a permanent aspect of myself.
Right, and we only use one. We only have one of those things in English.
Right, and to say like I am hot, you know,
that might be permanent.
Well, actually, that's a bad example because that would be more of a have. But like, it's
hard to do. But
right, yeah. But I don't want to say that as an exact because there's a lot of nuance. There's a lot of
exceptions and then on top of that, and then on top of that, there's all the poetic qualities of a language. Right,
sure.
You might want to use if you're having an argument. You might want to use that more permanent. Feeling that more permanent word to denote where you are because you feel trapped in being at home, right? You might use that saying I'm at home and I'm stuck in a way of expressing your emotion, which is that other level of language, which is really hard to do in translation.
Right. Well, when you're composing a song or a poem, anyone who's ever done that in English knows that English is a hard language to rhyme in.
Yeah,
like you can people can
Orange,
get good
for example.
At it. Yeah, people can get good at it, but you know. Darn, what rhymes with purple? You know, whereas something like Spanish is comparatively easier to. But then, you know, Spanish also becomes easier from a meter. But English is extremely easy from a meter standpoint. From an accent standpoint, it's easy to find things that have the same stress marks.
Oh, cool.
The thing is, culture is built into language, too. I mean, a lot of that is, you know, the meanings that are associated with these subtle differences do reflect the culture.
Yeah.
I was having a conversation with my cousin a few years back, and she lived in Belgium, and her boyfriend was from Holland, and they both spoke Dutch. And she was saying how they have a lot of different words for happy, like just for expressing happiness in subtle ways in different contexts that just don't exist in most other languages. And I thought that was pretty fascinating. To, you know, she's like, and they're such a happy people.
It's like, words for happy.
Well, I mean, yeah, I mean, it makes sense that a culture that comes through, you know, has a very happy kind of tone to the culture would have a lot of words to describe happiness.
Yeah. And something I would recommend to folks is learn a second language if you haven't already. Because if you ever want to learn about your own language, your native language, learning a second language is the best way to do it.
Yeah, very true. Mm-hmm. The contrast.
I have a question about this.
Yeah.
You guys have problems with the translation, but is there a good way to do it? Have you thought about something that is less scary way to do translations?
Being aware of the translation. Like the idea of giving the translation authorship an immense amount of importance. Like the idea you should...
And also respecting the fact that it is a translation. That there's always going to be something lost in that translation.
I think that's the concern. Yeah. So when you mentioned this website that kind of does it transparently to you, the transparently is really the problem, in my mind, for a translation. You've got to be labeling the entire time, this is a translation, and therefore the meaning is from the translation interpretation of the original source.
Yeah.
And that doesn't normally happen in translation. And even if it does, people kind of ignore it. Like, you don't say, I read this translation of this book. Normally you say, you read this book.
Yeah.
Oh, you read French? I read English. Oh, you read a translation of that book. You have to kind of be aware of it. And so that's the concern I have.
Yeah. One of the great things about Babelfish was the fact that even as bad as the translation was on a regular basis.
You don't mean the actual fish that's in Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy.
No, I mean the website. The translation software. And Google Translate has this, although their translation is better. But it's, you can never forget that it's a translation. Because the translation is so haphazard, because it doesn't seem like a natural language. So you are having, you're forced to have a principle of charity when you're reading it to go, that's not going to be exact and it's kind of like this. So I'm getting the gist of it,
yeah.
Which it seems like that's where we should be.
Does that answer your question, Lindsay?
Yeah. That gives me an idea. Although I don't know how transparent this is. It seems like there is some way that you have to be signed up to make edits and stuff like that.
Right, but, right.
Yeah, I see where you're
going. And it does make a lot of sense. I mean, what they're doing is they're saying computer translation is never going to work, but let's make a kind of wiki ability of translation, which makes a lot of sense. Because if I do spend time to try to glean knowledge from a website that I partially understand, my time and energy doing that and adding to that information is a great resource to the next person that tries to get that information. Mm-hmm. So thank you very much. That's a worldwide lexicon or world lexicon. Worldwide lexicon.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Worldwidelexicon.com. And they're doing an API for it, which is nice. So more people can use it.
.org.
Thanks. And you can find, of course, the links and everything on geekspeak.org. And, of course, we do translation every week for the geeks to regular knowledge. I don't know. Is that what we do in translation? We're welcoming you now to ask us questions and we'll help to translate them to you. Phone 476-2800. And the phone number is 476-2800. Rick is standing by. Or you can call us toll free 1-800-655-5877. We're going to ask you to ask us anything you'd like about technology. We'll talk about it. We do that every week. And this week, it's all about your questions. So give us a ring. And ask us anything you'd like. GeekSpeak on KOSP is supported by the University of Advancing Technology, a private university offering master's degree programs focused in advanced technology. More information available at uat.edu/masters. GeekSpeak on KOSP is also supported by Santa Cruz Electronics, offering an extensive selection of computer and electronic parts, as well as support services. Santa Cruz Electronics is open daily at 2808 Soquel Avenue and online at santacruzelectronics.com. You're listening to Central Coast Public Radio, KOSP, Santa Cruz. My name is Lyle Troxell. In the air and with me are Lindsay Lonnie, Alex Leas, Miles Elam, and Rick is standing by to take your calls with questions and comments about technology. The numbers are 476-2800. Toll free 1-800-655-5877. I'll give that information out again after we do a couple more news stories. I think what we're at right now is Miles' discussion about Fourth Amendment protection in email.
Or the lack thereof.
And then after that, we're going to be talking about Cisco's new router and a wireless power consortium. Are you guys losing track of the news? I moved it lower.
Actually, no. It's just Etherpad's kind of freaking out on a couple of us.
So. Oh, really? I have the news stories starting again at line 109 right now on my page. I moved them below the break.
Oh, yeah.
So. We're using Etherpad, which is actually a product we've been using for about a year and a half, I think. etherpad.com. And if you go to GeekSpeak website and click on the show page, on the left-hand side it says Chat with the Geeks. You can be in a public room of Etherpad and help us along like David Ives does every week. He's awesome. So you can collect news and links and all that. Is he here in there today? He is. David, I, and Rick's there too. Great. Anyway, that's at Etherpad. Go to geekspeak.org to join the chat if you'd like. All right. What's going on with email protection?
Or the lack thereof.
Or the lack
thereof. The 11th Circuit of, Court of Appeals, which is the court that is in the southeastern portion of the United States, has made a decision that largely eliminates Fourth Amendment protection for email. And the rationale they give, I find as a technology person, fairly alarming, which is right now, let's say postal mail. Let's take an example that we all know.
I put a letter in the envelope and mail it to you.
Right. And we talk about the Fourth Amendment is the protection against illegal unreasonable search and seizure.
Mm-hmm.
That there needs to be a judge involved to say there's a probable cause, we need to take a look at this, and then the judge says, okay.
And this is a very simple – mail is a perfect example. It's a very – so if there's a police investigator and they want to know if you're committing a crime, theoretically they just walk up and look at mail, right? Open up mailboxes, look, open it up, read it. Oh, looks like no crimes here. Seal it back up, stick it in there. And right. That's very common in a lot of countries. You'll see mail be opened and resealed. In this country –
but very intrusive and not
– And that's right. In this country, it's illegal to do that. Without a court order saying you can do it.
Right. Without saying like, oh, this person we have probable cause is a, involved
criminal
in some white collar crime.
You're going to make an argument to a judge and the judge says, is the liberty of this person versus what's good for the community at large, which is more important in this case.
A drug dog found cocaine in this box. So there's a probable cause to open it up and seize it.
That's, okay. So what's going on with email?
So when you write a letter – and you have it in your possession, you seal it. The sender has Fourth Amendment protection.
Uh-huh.
And then when they put it in the mailbox, established precedent says that while it's in transit, both the sender and the receiver have Fourth Amendment protection.
Okay.
That the Postal Service is merely acting as a carrier and has no personal interest in it. And once it's delivered, the sender relinquishes their Fourth Amendment protections and the receiver gets full.
That makes sense. I never thought about the structure like that, but sure, it makes sense.
That's how postal mail is handled. Email, however, is being treated slightly differently by this court. It says that, okay, someone sends the email. Okay, they have Fourth Amendment protection. And it's in transit between the mail servers.
Mm-hmm.
And it has that protection for both.
So each mail server has the ownership of it?
Well, no, just as it's in transit between there. While it's doing the hops.
Right.
And then when it gets to the destination email server, then that right gets transferred over to the individual.
Okay.
And then that's the point where they can download it.
Right.
Once it's gone to that third party server, that ISP's mailbox,
mm-hmm.
and then you can go to download it. This decision is saying, okay, well, we've already done that transmission and that person gets a copy. So at that point, it's fair game and a cop can just issue a subpoena without going through a judge.
They're saying basically that the actual information transfer you can't interfere with. But once that's happened, you can then open and read the copy.
Right, because it's on ISP's servers and it's a third party and it's not, and you don't have...
That's ridiculous.
This is why I run
from a technology
my own email
standpoint,
server.
Yeah.
That's why you run your own email server.
And I have it only accessible over encrypted channels.
So,
right, but this
that's
is taking,
a serious
this
problem.
Is taking logic from the physical world, trying to apply it in a one-for-one, in translation,
yeah.
in a one-for-one manner, and the translation isn't one-for-one.
Well, let me ask you this. I mean, if you sent a telegraph in the day, and the person wrote a note about, took the telegraph down,
mm-hmm.
and that was a translate part, and that you had a real person like interacting with it. They commented and wrote it down on the piece of paper and then send it off to you. Could the authorities then come in and look at the imprint on the paper below that saying, we're not interfering.
I don't know the case law for that, although I'm pretty sure they could have asked the person who transcribed it and they could have said, oh yeah, this telegram came through that had this and this and this. But just as a postcard is under different protections from a sealed letter.
Really?
If a postcard is going through, you don't have that level of protection.
Oh.
Like someone could look and go like, oh, I see this this postcard, and the because the contents are more public.
Okay, but the contents on an email server should not be public. I mean, I assume that when Gmail receives my mail from me, it puts it in my account and no one else can read it.
Right.
But except for their automated systems that are looking
for it. We are assuming that.
Yeah.
And so the question is, does the law have to change there, or do people's expectations need to change?
Well, I mean, there's a really simple solution to this problem, and that is to use pretty good privacy encryption. Just encrypt your email and then send your private, you know, let somebody else decrypt it.
Right.
Of course, we all know a lot about that, and we don't use that very much.
Right. And
I think you and I have
pass
keys, right, Alex?
Yeah, I've used it for a while. I would always include my key in my emails. And eventually, my key expired, and I never got to, because that's the problem. You know, there are issues within the keys expire.
Yeah, it's not simple. That's for sure.
Yeah, and it's certainly not. Most clients are not easy to set it up like with encryption.
I guess my key's probably
right now, we're in the situation where everyone is sending postcards, and of the ones who even understand that they can, that there's a difference, that they could send a sealed letter, envelopes are hard to come by.
Right. It takes half a day to make sure your envelope works, and then it fails later. Your envelopes expire. I bought envelopes, but now they don't work anymore.
Right. There's a technical solution to the problem, but at the same time,
it should be a legal thing, I think. Because now, the other thing about it is everybody is sending encrypted email. There is no way to get a court to look at it. Like, that's the thing is, I kind of like the idea of a judge somewhere going, yeah, this looks really bad. We should investigate this. I agree with your, you know, I'll waive that person's liberty to some degree to let you look at their box. If we did encryption everywhere, it wouldn't be possible to do that.
There is a way to do it, which is actually the way the UK does it.
Oh, a third key?
Which is, basically saying you are required to give us the keys.
The thing is, that's so dangerous. Oh, require the user to give keys. Yeah, that's valid.
And there's been some pushes in the U.S. to have that as well, to say you will give us the
If you're interested in this topic, this idea of security and vulnerability and privacy, go ahead and go read. I'm blanking on the name of the book. I love him, too. Oh, his website is craphound.com. All the time.
Yeah, I got to say, though, I mean, the whole idea
Cory
of government requiring that we give them keys, our encryption keys for communication basically says government is allowed to snoop into our lives, period. We have no means of protecting ourselves, period. Which is kind of interesting because it ties back to, you know, a lot of the original ideas of the right to bear arms was to protect yourself from the government should the government ever completely go against you, kind of thing.
Right.
or there be sections or corruption, and you're getting yourself in a situation where you're saying the government is allowed, here's my keys, and I'm not allowed to protect myself in any way. You know, without
But the idea is the key is only handed off when the judge demands it, right?
Right. And this is the same like a safety deposit box. Right now, you would be required to give access to that safety deposit box if there was a legal order.
Right.
If there was a warrant for that.
You're supposed to get
in this case, the bank has the key escrow, has the copy of the key.
Well, and of course, they can drill it out. They physically have it so you can actually open it up. That's the thing with this encryption protocols is if you do it right, you can't uncrack it.
Right, 4096-bit.
The book that I'm talking about and the author is Cory Doctorow. He's an amazingly intelligent thinker on these kind of rights issues. He helped create the Creative Commons concept, or promotes it quite a bit. His book is called Little Brother. You can get it for free. All of his content's available for free online. And Little Brother is an adult, young adult near future thing that's about technology and government rights. It's a really interesting book. I'd highly recommend it. And the podcast is at craphound.com. I'll put it up on the Geekspeak website. Cory Doctorow is the author.
Another good one to include is Bruce Schneier for information. He was always known as kind of the crypto expert in the industry, but he's expanded where he does a lot of thinking about social impact on things and general sense of protection and privacy. So
yeah, some of his works tend to be fairly meaty, but he does have some generally accessible materials as well.
And then Schneier.com.
Bruce Schneier. Yeah, I think it's BruceSchneier.com.
I think it's Schneier.com. In any case, we'll put it up on the website. Good thinkers on this kind of topic. We should be taking calls because people are waiting, and I'm being rude because I haven't taken them. All right, so we'll go to... we'll go to Carol. And Carol's in Santa Cruz. And Carol, what's your question?
I'm using Avast, which I just downloaded.
The antivirus software?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And they say I should use their professional grade, the cost money, if I do any financial transactions on the internet.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know of any free security software that would protect me.
Are you in a Windows or Mac?
Pardon? I have Windows.
Okay.
Here's the thing. With regard to antivirus, yes, there are other free options. I mean, Avast has that free option as well. But the idea of if you pay money, then you will be safe is disingenuous on their part. I don't know if it's necessarily a lie. They are doing things that are putting more protection. But
basically, there's a whole bunch of issues and problems with being safe and secure online, especially, and no offense to people, but especially in Windows environment. And a lot of companies are meeting that demand, and it's a big business, and it's hard to do, and they spend a lot of resources doing it, and they're trying to get money on it. So a lot of these companies will say, well, here's a free version, which is kind of bare bones and doesn't have everything you need. And then we also have a paid version, which does a lot more. And yeah, their paid version is better and more safe and more secure. But it's always about a more level. There's no such thing as safe online experience, right? There's safer online experience. Alex, you happen to be a security expert.
There's one thing I've got to say. With all the software, you know, that's out there, and a lot of it does a lot of good. It's good to have antivirus on your system and make sure you're regularly updating. But more than anything, the point of failure is the person.
Right.
You need to, like, really start thinking about how you use your computer and just being cautious in certain ways, like, you know, not opening up attachments. Don't click on links that are, you know, you think are odd. Always apply your Windows updates.
Just think of your computer as an enemy, and
don't use IE.
Don't use Internet
Explorer. Yeah, and in terms of updates, make sure whatever browser you're using, probably don't use Internet Explorer, but whatever browser you're using, make sure it is as up-to-date as possible.
That's the biggest
thing.
Because
that's going to be the biggest vector that you get.
Every piece of software has a vulnerability, and somebody will take advantage of that vulnerability and be able to get into your machine. And the only way to make sure that doesn't happen is to have the most recent computer software solution that theoretically all the vulnerabilities have been fixed. And one of the reasons why we say don't use Internet Explorer is because traditionally Microsoft waits too long for repairs for their browser. And so you have a situation where you have a vulnerable software that's just vulnerable for a long time, which means more people can take advantage and exploit it. So when we're talking about Avast and they're trying to upsell you and, you know, say, give us money and we'll protect you more, it's true. You know, if you can go and invest in a better security system for your home, and if somebody breaks in, you're, you know, a little safer if you've got the guard duty on the corner.
Yeah, and don't get us wrong. Like, it's not an evil thing to give money to antivirus vendors.
No.
I mean, because it does take money to do what they do.
It's better than giving it to the virus producers.
Right. But at the same time, and this needs to be said in general for antivirus, is antivirus used to be a lot more effective than it is today.
Yeah.
Now, virus vendors, people who make viruses, check them against the antivirus software
to see if
it works or not before they release it. So when it's first released, it's guaranteed not to be caught by your antivirus software the first time around.
Yeah, the first time the virus, and that's what it is. It's a battle of speed, right? So you're gonna get, you could say you go and spend money on Avast and you get their updates, and then it updates all the time. Whenever a new person comes out with a virus, they launch it. It's only successful and actually works because they've already tested it across Avast, the most recent version of Avast. They went and bought it too, and it passed, which means that there's a window there where they go and the virus can propagate itself even though you have Avast. And then Avast figures that out, sees the virus, figures out the fingerprint on it, adds it to its dictionary, and then next time you do an update, you get the definition, and now you're protected from it. And hopefully that update happens faster than the virus propagates. And that, I guess, is reason why there's money involved from virus companies. It's not simple, and they have to provide a service to you. And it's back and forth. You know, you use the big boys like Norton or Avast or Symantec Norton?
McAfee.
McAfee,
also. They're probably one of the bigger.
Use one of these big ones.
McAfee Norton.
Those are the ones that are being looked and used as a baseline for virus creation. So do you use the big boys that are theoretically updating the libraries faster, or do you use some unknown that isn't being averted as easily? And that's a difficult thing. I don't have a good answer. I mean, my answer, honestly, is to be extremely careful in my Windows environment and know that if I have a slowdown and I feel like there's issues, I take a look at what my machine is doing, and then I wipe it clean and reinstall.
Right, but we have that technical knowledge to be comfortable with that, and it's hard to tell people to do that, especially if they're not as comfortable with their
computer. And, of course, the geeks are in this great space, right? We know so much about technology that we're not the people that get taken advantage of first, right? We do just the simple things that say, you know, don't
at least
open
not in
emails
our personal life.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. I mean, we've definitely been in a public, you know, a corporation environment where we don't control those systems, and we've had the experience of viruses. It's horrible. But the point is that what it's kind of like the person that has the locked mailbox, just their mail doesn't get stolen. Not because the person can't pop the mailbox, but because it's harder and there's other mailboxes that are open. And so that's kind of like the geek experience, I guess. What do you guys think? Do you think Avast is a good piece of software?
I've heard good things about it. I'm using AVG right now, and they're probably equivalent as far as usage and usefulness.
I liked AVG for a long time because it was one of those simple solutions. It was a good free product.
Right.
But they've really cracked down and they have a much better paid product, and I think most of these guys do.
Yeah.
There's one a few years back we were looking at having multiple antivirus in some of our forensics labs.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the ones we were looking at, or we looked at this one report where this person did a really excellent technical analysis on all the different antivirus at the time and what they were good at, what they weren't. Some are good at, you know, using signatures and having up-to-date signatures. Others are really good at detecting behavior of potential malware and identifying that quite accurately. And one of the ones that was up there, both for having very good signature releases, having, you know, being very up to date, but also having good heuristics and detecting programs that are, you know, based on behavior whether or not they could be bad, is Avira.
Avira.
A V I R A.
A V
I R A.
Okay, we're gonna put that up on the GeekSpeak website, geekspeak.org. Alex's research on virus protection for...
That was a few years ago. I didn't do the research of the initial report. But
you have a forensics lab where you work?
Yeah.
To figure out how people are hacking and cracking?
It's part of it. We also do a lot of litigation support stuff, so we have to do that within a forensics lab.
Okay, I have another question.
Go ahead, Carl.
You say that you're doing things that prevent the virus staying in your computer.
Yes.
Which is you wipe your system.
Yeah. What that means is I completely erase the hard drive and reinstall the operating system, get the updates, install all the software again.
It's like a bone marrow transplant without the chemo and radiation.
Yeah, and it's about as painful. No, it's not nearly, of course, but it is not a fun experience.
It's disruptive.
And it only works because I plan my whole life around doing that regularly, right? So I don't keep stuff on that machine. I know that machine is disposable. I know that at any point I can wipe that entire system and I won't lose any data because I make sure to use all my data in another place as well, basically.
You mean on another computer?
On another computer, on a backup hard drive. I keep my software disks so I can install the software again. It's just not a fun experience. And you only have to do it when you actually get infected. And I don't get infected very much. And the reason I don't is that I'm cautious and careful more so than the average computer user. And therefore, the average computer user is attacked. Like, I think all the time, like, well, you know, this machine's operating really, the speed and everything's operating really well, so most likely I don't have a spam system happening. But if I leave my machine on for a while, and then I come back to it, I move the mouse, and the machine's really operational and functional, I assume, yeah, most likely there's not a big thing going on here. But if I was a virus protection, if I was a virus creator, and I was sending out spam through people's computer, what I would do is as soon as mouse movement happened, I'd stop doing everything, just stop my process completely, and let the machine operate really well. And that way, the user wouldn't know there's a problem, and only use the cycles when the computer's not being used for anything else. And that would be a much more hidden, effective computer program. But the truth is, most people don't do anything when their computer slows down. Most people, it doesn't matter, and you get more cycle time if you steal the cycles, even if the user wants them. And so people probably aren't writing software that would trick me better. They're writing software that tricks everybody. Does that make sense, Miles?
Yeah. I just to close, don't use Internet Explorer.
Yeah.
And be extremely careful or avoid porn sites, gambling sites, and take a critical eye at social networking.
Don't click
thank
on
you.
Ads.
Carol, thanks for the call.
I hope we helped. Wait, still have
okay.
The thing about wiping your system, could you put that up on the website, how to do that?
Yeah, yes.
You can put a summary up there.
You can put
a
summary
up. System operates slowly, and I did upgrade to, I can't remember.
I could put it up there, but I wouldn't recommend you doing it by yourself. Unless you really want to. Yeah, it's just not a fun experience. You got to, go ahead, Lindsay.
I was just going to say, make sure that Avast has spyware software, that you get some freeware spyware software, if you don't have it already.
Thank you very much for the call.
Okay, thank you.
Bye-bye.
One thing just
to append. We didn't actually answer her helper.
Yeah. But well, the thing is, it's not an easy, like, oh, just do this and you'll be fine. It's not that type of question.
It's a really complicated series of steps.
I mean, let's put it in context. It's like a car repair shop saying, you know, when I get a dent, instead of trying to match color, I just repaint the whole car. Because, you know, then it's all the same color. It's like, yeah, that works if you have a paint shop. If you are a geek and it's easy to reinstall your whole operating system,
or rebuilding the engine. That sounds more like it.
Right. Rebuilding the engine would be a better analogy because it doesn't cost you anything except your time.
Right, and a few seals, and it doesn't expensive. But I can't lift an engine out of a car because I don't have the gear, and I don't know how to do it.
Yeah. Yeah, one quick add in there for if you go to geekspeak.org and click on the on our blogs. There's one under Alex's blog where I talk about just getting your basic internet security, your router set up, your wireless router, which helps protect you from the internet. If you just have your computer on your own network, it's an additional layer of security. So I definitely recommend taking a look at that.
Yeah, if you're on a Windows machine, don't plug your cable, your connecting right to your computer. You've got to have a metal box.
Whatever computer you have, just don't do that.
Yeah. And that means having a router in between. And Alex's article is great on that. We do have one more question we're going to talk to Ed in Paso Robles. Hi, what's your question today or comment?
Yes, I installed Opera. It was working nicely and added mail onto it. And something happened. The message, incoming message is blanked out, grayed out. I get the message is there because I can click on the deal that gives both the coding and the message, but the message by itself I can't get.
And you're talking about email messages in the Opera Mail client.
Mail.
Do you know
Opera Mail? Yeah, email messages.
I'm sorry, the Opera Mail client, or are you talking about going to a webmail like Gmail or Hotmail or Yahoo Mail?
No, the Opera Mail itself.
Okay. Yeah, I didn't even know Opera had a mail client. An email client.
Yes, they do.
Okay. Well, since I don't know about it, I'm not very helpful. The one thing I could suggest is doing the most recent update, but it sounds like there's an install problem or a bug in that software.
Okay.
Sorry.
Thank you.
Fellows. All right. Take care.
Bye.
Well,
someone stumped us.
So badly, I didn't even know that client. Did you know that Opera had a mail client?
I had
Alex?
No idea.
I knew that it existed, but I don't know.
You never run it?
I just wanted to make sure which one we were talking about, because it was kind of that, am I going to be able to help him? 50-50 chance? No.
Yeah, I'd like to squeeze one quick thing in here real quick. It was just a touch on one of the stories, and I'll just leave it as a little teaser. How we were talking about our Comcast getting the internet connections faster. Cisco has also recently come out with a router called the CRS3. It runs at 322 terabits per second.
Wow.
That's 40 terabytes.
Give us a metric that we can understand.
What they were saying is Hollywood is in trouble from this because you can basically transfer every film ever made from Hollywood to Bombay in about 4 minutes.
That's fast.
Wow. That's scary. I want that at home.
have we copied it just now? No, we need to copy it again. And again. Oh, wait, what do we do now? Let's copy all the movies again.
The computer and the hard drive.
That's fast. Fast.
GeekSpeak on KSP is supported by the University of Advancing Technology, offering master's degree programs for geeks to become innovators of the future. UAT.edu/masters. GeekSpeak on KOSP is supported by Santa Cruz Electronics, offering extensive selection of computer electronic parts as well as support services. Santa Cruz Electronics is open daily at 2808 Soquel Avenue and online at santacruzelectronics.com. My name is Lyle Troxel. Geeks today were Lindsay Lonnie, Alex Leas, Miles Elam. Answering the phones was Rick Filman, and you're welcome to ask us questions throughout the week, and we might even answer you, but we'll definitely be here next week at 10 a.m. on KOSP to take your calls with questions and comments about technology. This is Central Coast Public Radio, KOSP Santa Cruz. We're streaming and podcasting at kosp.org. Car Talk, which is coming up next on KOSP, is made possible by a grant from the Holly Family Fund at the Community Foundation of Santa Cruz County, and we appreciate their support. For KOSP, for Central Coast Public Radio, KOSP Santa Cruz, and for GeekSpeak, I'm Lyle Troxel. I'll see you next week, and don't forget, you can go to geekspeak.org to find all the links and information about today's show. Coming up next, Car Talk. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week.